Welcome to the Educated Patient Podcast. My name is Mike. I'll be your host today. And we are joined by Dr. Mitchell, an assistant professor for the Division of Rheumatology at Mount Sinai West Morningside. Dr. Mitchell, thank you for joining us today. Just to get us going here in our conversation around rheumatoid arthritis, I would love for you to create some context around who you are, where you practice, and how you got into this specific lane of medicine.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me this morning, Mike. My name is Saloni Mitchell. I am a mostly clinical rheumatologist practicing in Manhattan, both in the 59th Street Columbus Circle location at Mount Sinai and in Harlem. I got into rheumatology actually based on an elective I had in medical school where I really got to know some rheumatologists and got to see that they established these kind of long-term relationships with their patients, and a lot of the times were really able to help them with what was previously known to be a chronic disabling condition like rheumatoid arthritis. So that really inspired me to become a rheumatologist. I'm also really passionate about medical education and teaching trainees, but also patients. So kind of lines up well with what we're doing this morning.
Great. And we were chatting a little bit offline before we hit record today, just around the differences in for you as a professional, right? Like you could be more clinically focused, or you could be more academia focused, or even I imagine more boots on the ground, right? Like more in a treatment setting. So for my own curiosity, I'd love to hear more around the differences of those, or why you chose more of the clinical route.
Yeah, so absolutely. There's a lot of choices, especially when you do work at a large academic medical center like Mount Sinai. My passion is really patient care. I like seeing patients every day and following up with them. So I chose more of a clinical route. So currently I see patients most days of the week at either location. In my medical training, I did have more research experience, and I certainly think that's super important, but it's not what my particular passion lies in, per se. And then I do hope to carve out more time for medical education in the future.
Is that aspiration aligned with your desire to just get more of the right information, or more information in front of the patients that need it, or even for the docs for that matter, to build those relationships and have better outcomes on the backside?
Yeah, absolutely. Both from a patient perspective, but also in terms of trainees, I'm really passionate about teaching like future rheumatologists at the level of medical student, resident, fellow. So that's what I'm hoping to do more of.
I love that. Let's jump gears onto today's topic, rheumatoid arthritis. I'm hosting this podcast from the position of learning from every single doctor that I'm meeting with, and I'm looking forward to learning from you today about this condition specifically. And like, how would you even describe to somebody like myself or someone who has no idea what RA is?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's important to first make a distinction between the use of the word arthritis and what it means for people. So most people, when they talk about arthritis, especially as lay people, they talk about it like it's all one condition, but the reality is that there's many different types of arthritis and the treatment management of these types varies. So to simplify it, like we'll think about it like there's two big buckets. The most common type of arthritis is osteoarthritis, or just wear and tear. That's about 90% of people, but approximately 10% of people have something called inflammatory arthritis, of which rheumatoid arthritis is one type, which actually involves activation of the immune system. So rather than fighting bacteria and viruses, the immune system has actually been abnormally activated and it's attacking the joints. So this type of arthritis is more destructive, it's more inflammatory, and it responds to treatments that target the immune system, whereas just wear and tear arthritis does not.
In this second bucket, where about 10% of patients fall into, psoriatic arthritis also in that particular category?
Yes, psoriatic arthritis is in that category. Other types of spondyloarthritis, even connective tissue diseases like lupus can have inflammatory arthritis.
How How are like where are the differences in terms of like how I might fall into one bucket versus the other? Is one of them hereditary? Am I born with predisposition to go into one track or the other, or are there things that are leading to me to fall into one of those buckets lifestyle-wise?
Absolutely. The answer is all of the above. So we know that the development of these types of arthritis conditions is a complex interplay of both genetic and environmental factors. So the reality is that more people have the genes that set you up to develop something like RA than actually get RA. So having the genes and the family history is not enough. There's thought to be some sort of trigger for this condition to start, and that trigger can vary. It can be, sometimes it's another illness, it can be life stress, it can be exposures. We know, for example, like cigarette smoke is involved in the pathogenesis of RA. So not any one thing in particular, but kind of a combination of many factors.
Yep. Interestingly, I don't know if it's interesting or not for everyone else, but interestingly enough, for me, I have firsthand experience. My mom, after she gave birth to my youngest brother, she popped with psoriasis for the first time in her life. And so she's been battling psoriatic arthritis for close to 30 years now. But it didn't present until after she had her third child, which is for me, or as a layperson, right? It's like, how is it even possible?
Yeah, totally. That's actually not an uncommon scenario. I see a lot of, women that get diagnosed with autoimmune conditions around the time of childbirth, either before or after. Undoubtedly, hormonal changes and things like that are also, part of the stress response and immune activation pathways.
Do you see, gender differences in the predisposition to autoimmune conditions, maybe even zooming out beyond just what we're talking about here, but generally speaking for autoimmune, like are women versus men more predisposed, or what do you see on that lens?
Yeah, absolutely. Generally speaking, for all autoimmune conditions, the majority of them have a higher predilection of women who are affected. And there's a lot of possible reasons that that could be the case. First and foremost, obviously, women have two X chromosomes, so that certain genes are actually exhibited twice. So that can kind of affect, a higher gene dosage, so to speak, of certain predisposing factors. We also know that estrogen can modulate the immune function and it can enhance cell-mediated immune responses. So those are some of like the scientific reasons why women kind of have a higher predilection.
In terms of a diagnosis, so let's say I get diagnosed for the first time with any form of autoimmune disease, but let's talk more specifically around RA. What are best practices for me as somebody who's been diagnosed for the first time? Is it sh should I move aggressively on this thing? Do I need to almost create a team of medical professionals to help me navigate this? What have you seen as best practice?
Yeah, totally. We know that early and aggressive treatment of rheumatoid arthritis can affect multiple markers of disease activity long term. So, treating aggressively at the beginning can prevent the development of bony erosions and even deformities of the joints. It can lead to better pain control long term, better functional ability, even, things that you might think are unrelated, like cardiovascular disease. Treating aggressively can decrease inflammation and kind of all pathways of the body. So it's very important to establish, a medical team, including a rheumatologist, probably a good physical therapist, a great primary care doctor, to kind of start tackling this from all angles.
You mentioned earlier that this second bucket of arthritis they're inflammatory. And how much does sleep and diet and movement and non-medicated solutions come into play for people that are dealing with RA?
I think all of those things are really huge. The caveat is you can sleep and eat perfectly and do all the right things, and you can still get RA. and you can still get pretty bad RA. So those things are super necessary and important, but they're not by themselves sufficient to treat this condition. With that being said, we know a lot of people with autoimmune diseases have other symptoms like fatigue and sometimes things like depression. So treating, autoimmune disease holistically and making sure to emphasize all aspects of healthy living is super important to try to target all of the ways that autoimmune disease can really derail a person's life.
You mentioned really enjoying building relationships with your patients. I imagine with what you just said, doing all the things right and still having to battle the symptoms and things that come with having the condition. I imagine that starts to ripple out and have impacts on somebody between the ears and inside their brain with regards to feeling either overwhelmed or like, I'm never going to feel better, or many other kind of limiting beliefs, I imagine, that start to enter. How have you helped individuals navigate kind of the mindset, or even just like the kind of the thought processes that come along with feeling like they're never going to get over this? Because ultimately, they're living with this forever, but it's more about the management, right? So, how do you help them just kind of stay positive or optimistic in terms of their treatment?
Absolutely. That's such a good question. And honestly, it's easier said than done. I see a lot of really young patients struggle with this in particular. Something like rheumatoid arthritis can be often diagnosed in people of the age of like 20 to 30. Oftentimes, these people don't have other medical conditions, are not used to being on multiple medications or having chronic symptoms. So it can be really debilitating and hard to understand. I think it's really important to set up a partnership and say, I'm going to be here for you through every part of this. You can always reach out to me. Early intervention with like even professional mental health care providers is really helpful, trying to figure out what a person's support system is like in terms of family, trying to get them involved, see if they can come to appointments. I often have to counsel people, especially when they first come in, because they're feeling so badly, just reiterating that this is the worst you're going to feel. And it is going to get better, maybe not immediately, but it is. And over time, they kind of, just for me repeating that myself, I think they come to believe it and then they start to experience it, which can be really validating.
That's great. Is there any particular type of exercise? I want to talk about exercise and diet for a minute because those are two of my personal passions. From your experience, is there, for both exercise and diet, are there particular types of each that are showing to be better for managing with lifestyle with RA, or even worse for that matter, like maybe a diet or exercise regimen to stay away from?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of diet, I get asked about this a lot, and I think it's really important. There's been a lot of press and interest in the thought of like an anti-inflammatory diet. I think, the truth is people aren't doing the same types of randomized controlled clinical trials on things like diet and exercise as they are on pharmaceuticals. So you have to kind of take the available evidence with a grain of salt. We know that generally speaking, most people respond well to a Mediterranean style of diet, both from a perspective of inflammatory musculoskeletal conditions, but also just general health. So we know, for example, that things like red meat and highly processed food certainly seem to be associated with higher levels of inflammation. And if a patient is going to make any kind of dietary change, I say start there. And then trying to implement more of a holistic Mediterranean diet with like lean meats, vegetables, fruit, nuts, olive oil, and the like. I don't personally, recommend any particular supplements, because I think if you're really eating in that way, you're getting most of the things you need through diet, which is better absorbed. Anyway, in terms of exercise, there's sort of this almost reverse way of thinking of, oh, my joints hurt. I'm going to not move them and I'm going to be super careful. When it's really the opposite, if you don't move, you become more stiff, you lose some range of motion, and interestingly, your pain levels actually go up. So it's important to find some form of exercise that you're able to do without exacerbating your pain. It's super important to be active. The caveat is early on in the disease, when there's a lot of swollen and tender joints, you want to probably go, a less is more approach with things that are less, less hard on the joints, things like yoga, maybe working with a physical therapist, slow start, basically.
Yeah, more less impact type of exercise. Maybe
Totally.
even like some type of pool regimen where the pool is doing a lot of support for your joints, but you're still moving,
Absolutely.
things like that.
And occupational therapy specifically can be huge for people with RA. A lot of the times, RA affects the hands and wrists, and that can really impair people's ability to work, for example, work at a keyboard. And occupational therapists are specifically trained for that and oftentimes can provide specific modifications to make day-to-day things like getting dressed, going and doing your job, more possible.
What about fasting? Fasting seems to be a big buzzword for the last few years in the diet world.
Yeah, absolutely. Intermittent fasting is super trendy. Specifically for inflammation, I have not really come across any convincing studies that say there's a benefit. So I don't overall specifically recommend fasting. With that being said, we know that, obesity is really kind of linked to increased levels of inflammation. So if fasting is a modality that a specific patient uses in order to decrease their overall calories and lose weight, I think it's, possibly helpful in that role.
I've yet to find a topic, let's call it, where GLP-1s don't come into the conversation. I imagine similarly for you. So this is what I'm going to ask the question around GLP-1s, and if you've seen any evidence to support them helping with what we've been talking about a lot here, which is that word of inflammation and just managing RA.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely a lot of interest and a lot of research happening in the world of GLP-1s. Specifically in rheumatology, they're being studied in a lot of different conditions, including RA, including osteoarthritis even. And so far, the results are really promising. It seems like they do help with inflammation outside of just weight reduction, which is a little bit mysterious because we don't, I think, completely understand how they're doing that. I think we're going to see more and more of this down the line. I think I'm not at the point where I'm routinely prescribing GLP-1s for patients with inflammatory conditions, but I don't know. It's possible that that may change.
I have a family member who started taking a GLP-1 and has RA, but they didn't take it because of the RA. And this is totally anecdotal. Within a few weeks of them being on it, they were amazed at how it also impacted their like what they wake up with every day with their inflammation and what they were feeling in their joints. So
Yeah, that's so
it's
interesting.
interesting. How is AI revolutionizing the RA patient treatment world?
Yeah, I mean, how much time do you have? So we know AI is being used for a lot of different things in the world of RA, especially patient diagnosis, even reviewing results of things like synovial biopsies, at a granular level, now that I'm go on the patient portal, if a patient messages me, now I get an AI generated response template of what I could say back to them. So
Wow.
it's crazy. For RA, what I'm really hoping it'll do specifically is we struggle to define which of our RA patients are at an elevated cardiovascular risk. It seems like traditional cardiovascular risk calculators kind of miss RA patients. So I think that's one area where AI is being used, and I'm excited to see the results.
There's a few things that landed in my head from your response. One of them, it sounds like AI will scale your ability to help more people effectively and not just have a mass volume of patients that you're helping and you're spread thin, but it actually will help you scale your ability to respond to more people with more depth.
I certainly hope so. There's definitely a major, shortage of rheumatologists right now that's only expected to worsen over the next 10 to 20 years. So I think any tools we have that we can use to kind of expand our outreach to patients is worth looking into.
Do you see any generational differences in terms? You mentioned digital engagement and managing the patient experience with an app or AI. Or do you see differences between the generations in terms of their willingness to engage with that type of care?
Yes, but honestly, not to the level you think. I have a lot of older patients that are very, adept at using their patient portal and their, apps and stuff like that, which actually, has surprised me. But certainly, I think I learn something new from my Gen Z patients every day, actually. One of them taught me recently, that your iPhone health app can actually keep track of your medications. You can put them all in there and it can give you reminders on when to take them. So yes and no.
Wow, I just that you just helped me learn that. I love
Yeah.
that. Great. I have a few more questions. I'm curious to wrap this conversation up here with future outlook and just pick your brain on what you're excited about in terms of innovations or the future landscape of RA.
Yeah, absolutely. Such a hot topic right now. So much interesting research coming out. I think one really a gap in patient care that we have, we know we have a lot of medication options. We don't always have a good idea of what patient is going to respond to what therapy. So I think there's going to be a role for like personalized medicine in RA where we're able to somehow predict, oh, this patient, has a high TNF signal and would respond better to a medication like Humira, for example, versus methotrexate. We don't really know that yet. So there is a lot of, unfortunately, trial and error that happens when a patient is first diagnosed, where we may have to go through a few different medication regimens until we find that one that works. So that's one particular area.
What do you think the most important question is that any RA patient should be asking their doctor if they haven't already?
Ooh, that's so interesting. And I'm not sure there is just one. You should ask a lot of questions, but I would ask a lot about, what can I be doing to prevent, long-term consequences of RA? Because it's more than the medications, right? It's all of the lifestyle things we've been talking about. It's coming to appointments regularly. It's really staying on top of things. So have to have a good working relationship at the level of both the patient and the physician. So I think, asking and learning specifically about that is very important.
Final question. I appreciate your time today, Dr. Mitchell.
Of course.
If there's any newly diagnosed patient or maybe even a family member of a newly diagnosed RA patient, what is the one thing that you recommend this individual should do this week to take control of their health in this newly diagnosed state?
I would say that they should learn as much about the treatment regimen that's been recommended to them and stick to that to the best of their ability. And if they have any questions and feel like they're not getting the answers they want, don't be hesitant to seek a second opinion. It can be really helpful to kind of find a second provider to give an additional explanation. A lot of patients feel hesitant about doing something like that, but it can be really useful.
I love that. And kind of ties all the way back to the beginning of our conversation today, where you mentioned valuing the patient relationship the most for the work that you're doing. And it sounds like your encouragement is for them to engage in that patient relationship and not wait for the doc to engage them, but to actually also play their part and build trust with their provider.
Absolutely. It's a two-way street, and it's worth the attempt.
Love that. Well, Dr. Mitchell, thank you for your time today. Thank you, everyone, for listening to today's episode of the Educated Patient Podcast. If you're looking for more information on rheumatoid arthritis, please visit our website, theeducatedpatient.com, and stay tuned for more episodes in specific disease states and conditions that may be specific to you or a family member, or you may even be a caretaker. We're here to bring the most knowledgeable experts in the world right in front of you to help consolidate all of this information to for everyday practical use. So thank you, Dr. Mitchell, and
Thank
have
you
a
so
great day.
much.